Lee Herrick is the author of This Many Miles from Desire. His poems have appeared in many literary magazines and anthologies, including the Bloomsbury Review, Zizava, Highway 99, a literary journal through California's Great Central Valley, and One for the Money, The Sentence as Poetic Form, among others. Born in South Korea, he lives in Fresno, California, and teaches at Fresno City College and in the Low Residency MFA program at Sierra Nevada College. Lee, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on your new book, Gardening Secrets of the Dead. I don't know if people know this or not, but our very first show on Words on the Wire was with Juan Felipe Herrera. And you know who did Poetic License? Do you remember, Lee?
I do. That was fun.
Yeah, Lee did the Poetic License. He did our very first one, and it was about community, and it was awesome.
And I remember that, and it was awesome. And you have to do some more Poetic Licenses for us, Lee, by the way.
Yes, as many as you'd like. Ben and I end up doing them all.
Because if you don't promise to do one, this interview stops right now.
So, Lee, congratulations on this book. Tell us about Gardening Secrets of the Dead. Where did you get that title?
Well, thanks. I'm happy about it. And the title of the book is actually a title of one of the poems. I think it's the third or fourth poem in the book called Gardening Secrets of the Dead. And so, you know, that poem captures a lot of what I think the book is working with. So, yeah, you know, I struggled with the title for quite a while. The first book, This Many Miles from Desire, that title had come to me probably 3 years before the book was even published. The second one was quite a bit more of a struggle. In fact, I changed the title.
What did it used to be?
For a while, I was working with the title Bone Echo. It never felt quite right, and so I knew that before the book was published, the title might change. And so, you know, I was just looking over some of the poems, and that one felt right.
You know, that really makes a lot of sense that you would call it Gardening Secrets of the Dead. I'm looking at a particular line right now. It says, "A dead woman told me gardening simply is laughing and swimming a chorus of little brown miracles." It kind of, in a sense, echoes the recurring images and recurring themes of this book, which is about a woman who gave birth and a child who doesn't know where that woman is. Is she dead? Is she alive? Whatever happened to her? But there's a lot of stuff about being a Korean adoptee in this book, much, much more than I think This Many Miles from Desire.
Yeah, you know, This Many Miles from Desire was written over the span of about 10 years. And during that time, I'd only been back to Korea once. I should say, just for your listeners, if they're not familiar with my work or my life, I was born in Daejeon, South Korea, and adopted at 10 months to the United States. And so the second book, Gardening Secrets of the Dead, was written in about a four-year span from 2007 or so to 2011. And during that time, I went back to Seoul. I went back to Daejeon, the city where I was born, and was able to fill in a lot of the missing parts of my life, be those cultural or even with nature and family. A lot of the questions that are working through the book are sort of responses of sort of an increased certainty that I had or an increased sense of license having been back to the city where I was born. And things like that. So, yeah.
Do you feel like going back to the city where you were born, that it was some kind of return? And I ask that question because it seems that your life wasn't that reality. It was a different reality than what you were born. So if it's a return, what kind of return is it?
A lot of what we learn, I think, as writers is good advice, things like write what you know. And for many writers, that is a place and a time and a person, meaning birthplace, birth town, and birth date. And so, of course, having those three things in place doesn't guarantee any writer or any person any kind of certainty or ease. But for the adoptee, at least many Korean adoptees that I know, those three things are not only unknown, they are often shifting. So in other words, I technically don't know the day I was born, and I haven't yet met any of my birth family, and I grew up most of my life believing I was born in Seoul, the capital city of South Korea. In fact, my first book, the bio, says I was born in Seoul. But in 2008, when I returned, I found out that I was, in fact, born in Daejeon. And so I think, at least for me, the poem or the art is a way to sort of navigate that middle ground. It's almost like a border or an anti-border, where the language and the suppositions, culturally, geographically, chronologically, have to sort of be grappled with in the poem. But to answer it specifically, if I understood your question right, returning to Daejeon was a, you know, for lack of a better term, it was an incredible experience. I felt something very strange come over me when I got off the express train in Daejeon. It was sort of hard to explain.
When you enter into that city and you see the landscape, you see a tree that has been there as long as your mother has been there and beyond. You see buildings that were there that your family has seen, and maybe a tree stump where your family has sat to rest, that it connects you to a very deep part of your imagination.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And it all felt very natural. You know, I think some of the things going on in the second book are questions of what would the dead say to us if they could speak to us, or if we were listening, or what would we say to them? Yeah, it was a very sort of surreal experience.
But isn't it true that all of those conversations are projections of us? That, in fact, the real question is, what do we say to the dead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in many ways, I can't speak for other poets, but I always wonder if other poets are writing some version of that story, our response to the dead and to the future. And, you know, my experience as a sort of international adoptee is unique in just that way. But I think of other things, for example, countries or families affected by war, or even domestic separation issues of violence. But certainly, you know, I think the book talks about those things, and I think many poets are working with those issues.
You know, it reminds me of a interview that I was listening to on the Poetry Foundation with Robert Pinsky, and he said that he was touring through Africa and visited a witch doctor, for lack of a better term, that's how a Westerner would refer to who he consulted. And the witch doctor was going to read him and advise him. But he wanted to make it clear that they do not worship their ancestors, they just consult their ancestors. And for him, that became kind of a metaphor for his poetry, that, you know, the dead is there. Yeah, whether it's the dead poets that came before us or our literal ancestors, the dead is there and we consult them, but we don't worship them.
Mm-hmm. I like that story a lot. I think there's a lot to that, in that worship or idolatry is a sort of a different issue of, be it cleansing or you know, something spiritual or religious. You know, some of the poems in the book are certainly about exiled or deceased artists and poets, but quite a few of them are poems of friends of mine who are younger than me who passed on.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know if I'm putting more into the poems than there should be, but I think that I'm often trying to manage a lot of these things simultaneously, and however they work their way into a specific poem, well, that's in the poem. But I don't know. I've found that I carry those things with me a lot, those people.
Yeah, I think I do too. I think I'm thinking of my first book called Calendar of Dust, and there was one particular reviewer that says that I was a typical Mexican obsessed with death. And I thought that was really a cheap shot.
Yes, you were.
Because death is the way that you view death, and what you're talking about, death is just a reality. It really is integrated into living and into one's work, and it seems very natural. It doesn't make it an obsession. You know, the people die, that we lose people, that they become a part of the present. The past is always in the present. The dead are always in the living. And I think that it's very healthy to have a conversation with people of the past that move us. By the way, I really love your poem, Van Gogh Writes to Gauguin. And there's the gardening imagery there as well, the olive tree. And I'm wondering, too, that integrated into the gardening secrets of the dead, the idea of gardening and the dead together. Gardening is a living thing. When you garden, you're bringing life from the earth, and you're helping to kind of nurture it and bring it forth. Do you garden?
I don't garden. I wish. It's one of those things we all wish we could do. You know, the person I wish they could play the guitar. In my mind, I'm very talented in the yard, and I can grow all of these wonderful vegetables. But no, I can't. Although, you know, I love being outdoors and working with things. But the title refers more to a poetic or human sort of context, in that the reader could say be mining the dead for her secrets. Or the reader could be exploring the questions of the dead or the living and what they want to know, or what they think the dead or the living, who's withholding things, what they might share. And then also just, you know, a different way of looking at it semantically would be what the dead are going to offer us, I suppose.
One of the things that really fascinates me about books of poems, ever since Ben and I have been doing this show, I read more books of poems in a week than I read anything else. And one of the things that interests me is when the poet has come to recognize that they have a book. And what is that recognition? Is it the amount of pages? Is it recurring images? Is it themes? When did you know that you had a book?
I think the first book, it was more just a number of pages. You know, I felt like
which often happens, I think, with first books. You just arrive at a number of pages and go, I think I could put a book together.
It was more that way with my first book. This one felt a little bit more deliberate in what I was trying to do thematically, and so I knew I was getting close when I had a certain number of pages, but there was a last poem or two that I wrote that I thought tied the collection together well, specifically the poem in the book called The Heart, which gave the book a sense of finality for me.
And so why isn't it the last poem then?
It's a really good question. I decided to put The Heart as the second to the last poem because the last poem that ends the book right after The Heart is called Freedom. And those two poems are, of course, part of the last section of the book. And that section of the book is really a series of poems that I was writing sort of during and after a difficult period of my life in 2008 in a personal way. A difficult marriage ended, and so I was writing a lot about the heart and perseverance and faith and things like that. So I knew The Heart needed to go towards the end, but Freedom opens up the book in a more general way to close it out, I felt. Freedom not just about the heart or in a personal context, but just in a liberating way that might apply to anybody in any number of circumstances that they're going through. There's a line in Freedom that says we have the open architecture for such capacity. And I think that I was trying to speak to a larger audience beyond just the personal or the relationship.
It's that poem, Freedom. I'm looking at it, and it says, look, start over. We have the open architecture for such capacity, a new line, a real shift, as if that's actually tied to writing.
Mm-hmm.
And you tie it to writing. To start over, to reimagine, means is also tied to writing a new line. A new line for yourself, but a poems, which is very Dickinsonian. You know, I was talking to Daniel about this poem last night. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. And I love that poem because it means that after she's experienced this pain in her life, this formal feeling is the poem. That's the formal feeling.
Yeah.
And the poem ends, this is the hour of lead, which is to say writing the instrument, because there's no other way to interpret that,
mm-hmm.
that line. This is the hour of lead,
mm-hmm.
remembered if outlived,
mm-hmm.
as freezing persons recollect the snow.
Mm-hmm.
First the chill, mm-hmm. then the stupor, then the letting go.
Yeah.
And that's like freedom, right?
Yeah, the hour of lead, I mean, those lines are so wonderful, and I do think freedom has elements of that. I hope it does. In fact, and I appreciate that close reading, Ben, but, you know, when I wrote the line, a new line, a real shift, I was thinking of the poem, and so I think you're right on.
Mm.
I think that writing, at least poetry for me, is often very exhausting, and so I think just to understand the sort of cyclical struggle of an individual poem, much less longevity. This is just my second book, and I wonder, and I read, and I think about poets who are able to create and recreate poem after poem or book after book based on what they're living. And so I guess in one sense, freedom is a reminder to myself to not let logic and difficulty and things like that sort of obscure what the art is really trying to say to us in a more meaningful sense.
You know, it is exhausting, Lee, to write poetry, and it has to be, necessarily so, I believe, because you're writing about things that matter to you. The poet writes about things that matter to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that poetry helps the poet to survive the losses and the hurts,
mm-hmm.
and to respect those losses and to give them their due. And so it's about recovery, but it's also about survival. You know, the survivor always tells the tale. So the poet is always the quintessential survivor, don't you think?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. There was an epigraph in the first book that I wrote that from Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk, and I'm a Christian, but I like his words. It said, suffering is not enough. We must also be in touch with the wonders of life. Absolutely. You know, at least the poets I admire, I like that. I'm going to have to use that in a poem somehow, the quintessential survivor. Yeah.
We're talking to Lee Herrick, whose new book just came out, his second book of poems, Gardening Secrets of the Dead. Lee, when you put this book together, did you print all the poems out and put them on the floor and decide where they're going to go, what order they're going to go in?
You know, I know I printed them all out, and I don't know if I was on the floor or on the kitchen table, but I did spread them out and look at them in that way.
That's got to be one of the most satisfying things for a poet when they know they have reached enough pages to print them all out, put them on the table or the floor, and decide the order of things.
It's a great thing. And I, you know, at least for me also, I'd say that you know you're getting close, but you're certainly not done, right?
Yeah. And then, but that's when you start writing poems to make the book, to shape, to make it a book instead of just a collection of poems, so that it'll have the kind of narrative arc that we want to give it.
Definitely. Definitely. And if nothing else, the laying out of the poems allows you to see those gaps that Ben might be speaking of there.
And you know what? Because I'm also a novelist, the novelist, when you finish a book, it doesn't have that kind of physical, visceral joy to it. Because you can't, I mean, the pages are just they're numbered. You can't spread it all out. You can't, you know, the decisions are already made, you know, and you just print it out. And so, like, it's not fun that way, in the way that you have fun with poems, because that's also fun.
By the way, I have to mention, excellent job, Lisa. Lisa Lee, your partner, did with this cover. She designed it. It is so beautiful. I love how the robe of this young woman on the page with this really beautiful robe, technicolor robe, and as it streams down to the bottom of the page, faces emerge, children emerge, these people emerge. It's really beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you.
And can I ask you about something on the image that's really arresting? That the young woman is so feminine and fragile, and yet the hands are so masculine and large.
Mm. Yeah, the cover artist is a woman originally from the Cambridge, Boston area. She's a Korean adoptee, incidentally. But her name is Joo Young Choi, and she is an incredible artist. And so her cover is the one you're speaking of. And Lisa, my fiance, did a great job designing the book. The face of the woman on the cover, to me, is very Korean. This Korean concept of Han, or sort of a cultural sort of malaise or sadness, to put it one way. You know, Korea, of course, is a country affected by war, and that war, quote, sort of ended, although it's still technically going on, in 1953. And so there's a lot of weight, I think, in the woman's face. And yeah, her hands are heavy. I think her hands are darker.
Yes.
Yeah, it just felt like the perfect cover. I feel very lucky that she let me use it.
You grew up in Modesto, California, and where I used to live and I used to teach. In fact, Lee and I knew each other at the college I first taught at. We were both teaching there. But you grew up in Modesto, which is very middle American in a sense, very middle class, and it's quite white, frankly, some of the neighborhoods there. I remember living there for a while and feeling very alienated at times as a Chicano. I remember being followed to my class. I was a professor, being followed to my class by security because I parked in faculty parking. I mean, it's really kind of a, you know, it's an interesting community. Very, very conservative. Very, very conservative.
Yeah.
At what point did you know that you needed to find out who you were?
Before I lived in Modesto, I lived in Danville. I was adopted, and then I sort of landed in the United States in October of 1971. And for about 8 years, I lived in Danville in the East Bay. And then my family moved to Modesto, which, as you say, is fairly white. It's now a city of about 200,000 people. And by car, it's only about an hour and 15 minutes from San Francisco, but in other ways, it's much further from San Francisco. You know, in the 70s, I was the sort of stereotypical situation where I was the only Asian kid at the school and things like that. So being an adoptee in a white family with whom I'm very close and love dearly, but nonetheless, they were Caucasian and I'm Korean. And so growing up, I had a fairly comfortable childhood, but the first time, if I remember your question right, the first time I started to think I needed to really be a little bit more aware of race dynamics or things like that, I think I was about 18. I was walking, no, maybe I was about 20 years old, and I was back visiting my parents, and I looked on the hallway wall, and they had gotten this photograph developed. It was a formal family picture. And, you know, this was way before cell phones with cameras and everything. And it was the first formal family portrait that I'd ever seen. We'd had a lot of other pictures taken, but they were all candid or, you know, out camping or doing whatever. But we'd never been in a studio with nice sweaters on. And I looked at this photograph. I was about 20. And it was one of the most striking memories I have of really, really looking different than them. I mean, of course, I knew I looked different than them growing up my whole life. But I remember that instance. It sort of jumped out at me. And that probably just coincided with the time of being in college and reading some good books. And that was a big, big turning point for me. That time, about 2021, I began to learn a lot. I began to travel a lot more, feel a lot more comfortable around Asian Americans and Korean Americans, which might sound strange, but as somebody who never did grow up around that, the food, the culture, the people, I almost had to relearn it as a 20-year-old. And so now I'm very comfortable around those things or in those countries. But that was a defining moment for me, and I think it was very liberating as a very young writer, realizing that those things were for me, that culture was for me, that there were problems with racism in the United States, and I could start to make sense of how they'd affected me.
You know, just as I suspected, and as is very evident in your work, your development as a poet, as an artist, coincides with your consciousness of who you are politically and socially and culturally.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
And Lee, to end today our interview, I'm sorry we don't have more time to talk. It's been wonderful to have you on the show. We always have a segment where we have the poem of the week. And when we have a poet, we have them read a poem. Usually we ask them to select a poem, but I've selected one that I'd like you to read for us today.
Okay.
Could you read Circle?
I'd be happy to. Circle, can I just say a word about the poem?
Yes, absolutely.
It's for Jennifer and Sun Young Shin. Sun Young Shin, as I think some of your listeners might know, is the great poet from Minneapolis. Her second book just came out with Coffee House. It's called Rough and Savage. And she's a spectacular poet, and she happens to be a Korean adoptee who I met when my book came out, the first book. It was the same year her book came out, 2007. And the other person to whom the poem is dedicated is Jennifer Kwon Dobbs, who also is a Korean adoptee. Her first book came out in 2007, the first year mine came out. So I went through a long period of writing where I thought I was the only one. And when our books came out, we were among the first Korean adoptees to have a book of poems published. It's been a wonderful, wonderful experience getting to know them and being inspired by them and so on. So the poem is sort of for them. It's called Circle. Once I thought I had memory, round dry leaves in a pile, Korean, full of smoke, autobiography as division, north of the Han River, south of it, the 63 building, a gold rocket, all the red neon crucifixes lit under Seoul's hopeful twilight. The Imjing River's heavy bloat, the guard posts with handprints of former soldiers, like my translator who helped me try to find my birth mother. You write about paper and savagery, all the dying and flowers to the left, all the dying and flowers to the right, all the children eating popsicles to the left, all the children eating popsicles to the right. Your shattering elegance, you graceful astronomy, you turn into doves, you sword of fire through the snow, we will remember it all.
The lovely poem.
Thank you.
Thank you for being our guest on today's show, Words on a Wire.